Okay, you want to do roll call?
Sure. Okay, we've got Marsha, East Hartford. Chris Edge, Berlin. John is here. Sandra is here. Bob Bessel, Canton.
Yep, here.
Great. Mark Walter, Columbia. I saw you. John Elsesser.
Here.
Jim Hayden.
Here.
Lori Spielman. CJ Thomas is here. Chip is here. John Ward Granby.
Yep, here.
Great. Scott Shanley. Brock Weber, New Britain. Bob Lee is here. John Mayer, Rocky Hill is here. Maria Capriola is here.
Here.
Mark Shoda, Southington.
Here. Here.
Mike Rosen, Tolland. Mike Rell, Weathersfield.
Here.
Erica Wazinski is here. Peter Souza.
Here.
Excellent. Matt Hart is here. Chris Kervick, Windsor Locks.
Here.
And Vicki Shotlin is here. Or should I just say Vicki?
Yeah, Vicki's good. I'll hide that way.
Other outside agencies, Jean Goddard, Metro Hartford.
Here.
Kathy Lutz, Rome Smith and Lutz.
Here.
Sana Shah, forgive me if I pronounce that wrong.
Sana, thank you.
Okay. And Erin Sheehan is with you?
Yeah, she is.
Super. Maureen Lawrence from CTDOT? Not yet.
Grayson, I think she just joined.
Okay, super. Grayson Wright?
I'm here.
Okay, Betsy Gara, Cost?
She was here, but...
She was.
I'm here, sorry.
Okay, Ellen Graham from Senator Blumenthal's office. And Lori is calling me right now, so.
Okay, so I believe we have a quorum and we can probably move on. I'm not sure there's anyone from the public on that would like to make a comment, but that is, so is there anyone from the public that would like to comment?
Chris Edge, Town of Berlin. Just want to say I'm here as well. Kim, if you can mark me down.
Oh, hi, Chris. Thanks.
Sorry, Mayor.
We gotcha.
Thank you.
Do I have an approval of the minutes from the September 16th, 2020 meeting?
John Coleman moves approval.
Second.
Any discussion? Corrections? If none, do I? All in favor?
Aye.
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 And the motion carries. Next we have Lyle, who will review some of the correspondence and handouts included in your packet and some copies of the letters that were sent.
Thank you, Mayor. The first letter is a all delegation letter of the entire congressional delegation in support of our $10 million, give or take, Economic Development Administration application. So that was very nice. The governor's office and the governor's lobbyist has also weighed in with EDA. We are now waiting, and maybe as early as this week, for the review committee to go over the application, and we will certainly inform everybody. Of course, the options are, it can be accepted in whole, rejected in whole, or they can come back with a midpoint in terms of the $10 million. So that letter went in, and we're hopeful, being a statewide application and not a sort of a variety of little bits and pieces, the governor and the legislative delegation, federal delegation have all weighed in. So that's, I think, the first item. The second item is a letter that was sent based on the conversation we had here with Congressman Larson on a need for pressing Capital Region infrastructure. And Mayor, this is something to think about for the future, and that is you had a presentation from the Hartford 400 infrastructure group that Congressman Larson put together recently. It might be worth going over that at a future policy board meeting. Basically, the bottom line is this is an aggressive group that Congressman Larson put together. If, in fact, a large federal infrastructure bill becomes available, we would have a concept-level plan it's not a detailed transportation plan, but a concept level plan to deal with the I-84, I-91 interchange, levees, and not levees, but dikes and road reconstruction in the region. So that letter, I think Congressman Larson has talked to Governor Lamont about, and Mayor, this is something that you may want to consider, that we have a broad presentation of the infrastructure plan that you received at your council meeting.
I think that would be really great. I think Doug presented a great plan, and it probably was about a 20-minute, half-hour presentation, if I timed it, which I didn't. But it's very intriguing. I think the time is well spent for it to be kind of talked through, especially in the CROG area.
So the suggestion, Madam Chair, would be to stick that on a future agenda. We have to put a few asterisks after it that it's not following the regular transportation approval process, but it's really a concept plan. The other piece is, even though it's concentrated within the 3 or 4 miles of the core of the region, the 84, 91 traffic, as well as the interchange of those, plus the other aspects, are really region-wide in their impact. So even though, as I say, it's focused on the core of the region, it impacts the entire region. So if there's a sense of the board, we can certainly ask Doug Sussman and colleagues to come and present in a future meeting, if that's your wish.
How does everyone feel about that?
I'd be curious to hear what they say.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you, Mayor. We'll do that.
I had one question for you, though, in regards to that, and I didn't ask it that night, but I was thinking about it. So I know that Congressman Larson's original plan was to a reconnection of the 84 through a tunnel, right, and tunnel the whole.
Yep.
What for transportation? What's the difference between, because truck traffic can't go through a tunnel. Can truck traffic go through the tunnel that they're proposing along the levee system?
It depends on their cargo. There may be a need for a bypass for trucks carrying certain categories of materials, which has been typical anyway in terms of any kind of major tunnel. You can't go through there with certain kinds of materials. But I think what's interesting about this project, Madam Chair, is that it's not just the earlier proposal Congressman Larson had about a tunnel. This is actually much more comprehensive in terms of the 2 to 3 mile circle around Hartford and East Hartford. So it doesn't just deal with that, but it deals with reconstruction of the riverfront, the Mixmaster.
I was thinking more along the 91 that's going to run along the, that would be somewhat underground, not quite as deep as a tunnel.
Right.
But
some of it could be capped. So this is the kind of issue we can sort of bring up. It's actually very complex, but it's not the original proposal of tunneling. But one of the major elements is finding a way for through traffic on 84 not to have to get into a spaghetti situation. And as you well know, when you come from 84 east going westbound, it's kind of a dodgem cars to get into the 84 west right now anyway. So we need to fix some of those things. So
are you proposing a 291?
Yeah, we can. And again, I have mentioned more than once that, we really need a big picture on this. So I can talk to, I think there's agreement, a consensus on the board. We'll go ahead and try and set that up. But there's a lot of questions. But I think this is, the point about this is, it's a concept level plan that if, in fact, a large infrastructure bill becomes available, we would have a concept level plan in there to get our oar in the water, rather than waiting to react. And the point about it is that we have a number of key legislators here, with Congressman Larson, Congressman Neal up the road in Ways and Means, Rosa DeLauro, maybe a props chair. There's a whole series of alignment of the stars that would be good for us to have our concept level plan. And of course, it will still have to go through, the usual transportation and environmental plans, but at least we'd have a concept plan on the table. So I'll proceed with chatting with Doug Sussman to get follow up on that.
Great.
My other report, the federal liaison, AKA a lobbyist. There's four organizations in partnership on this, Pioneer Valley, Franklin County, CROG, and the Knowledge Corridor. All four of them now have approved their share of the funds. Pauline is drafting the RFP, and we will proceed apace on that. So just to let you know, I think it's very valuable. You know, even though we have a good relationship with our federal delegation, to have somebody worming the halls of Congress and the administration looking for opportunities. So we'll keep you posted on that. I think that's coming along well. The Hartford to Boston Rail Economic Impact Study is well underway. Tim Malone is the star on that and the lead on that. And Rob on the call obviously is the lead in the whole planning area, but that's coming along well. We have, you know, as I said, made good progress on that. In terms of COVID recovery, we have a lot of issues going on here, but I just want to highlight one that I'm very interested in. And that is right now that there's a program called Community Resource Coordinators. If there's a family in your town that needs assistance in isolation and quarantining, who may have, you know, crowded living conditions or other kind of barriers, these are in each of the regions in the state. But the issue is, after that two-week quarantine and isolation, how they get passed over to a case management system to continue to meet those needs. And so the issue, you know, not dropping the ball after they've gone through the quarantine period. And we heard the first example in the CROG region of a family with these COVID needs, and it was almost laughable how many, you know, how complicated it was. You know, grandma's got a heart problem, the kids are special needs, and the whole thing was just this, it was almost, as I say, if it wasn't tragic, it'd be laughable. So we're gonna be meeting shortly on figuring out how we pass from the COVID phase to a support their needs afterwards. So that case management, I think, will not be one size fits all. Out of our 38 towns, there's a lot of different approaches to case management. Some towns have a, you know, large human service case management capacity, others don't. And so we're gonna have to sort of thread the needle with that process. So that's coming along pretty well. And we're actively participating. And I think, Mary, you got an email too on this, on the GRI, the Crystal Group, interviewing people for the first phase of assessment, which needs to be done by December 31st. So they're under the gun to get our first phase done. The following phase for years 21 and 22 are what's up for grabs at the EDA $10 million grant level. So, but that COVID recovery, United Way of Connecticut is in it, United Way of North Central Connecticut and others, but to find a way of not dropping the ball after the quarantine isolation period's over. So that's my major report. I don't know if there are any questions, Madam Chair, on my report. The monthly report, I think, just indicates a lot of things are moving ahead anyway, despite the pandemic. And I want to thank my department heads and others for, as I say, continuing to move a pace with this. And we're, I guess the last point is, we're like everybody else here watching the COVID rate at 4.1%, and our reopening plans are going to be dependent on what happens in the next 2-3 months on this. And again, frankly, I'm a bit of a worrywart on this in terms of cold weather closing outdoor establishments, family gatherings, and people getting fatigued with COVID measures. So I think we will all be in this boat, but CROG is going to be watching very closely in terms of our percentage of staff that are back in the office and so on. So the COVID rate, we're watching very closely. So that's my report, Madam Chair, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Any questions for Lyle?
Oh, I forgot Halloween. I don't know if you wanted to discuss this, but I got questions on this, and the only clear direction I've heard on Halloween is from Meriden, which is not, but in other words, in my neighborhood is there trick-or-treating kind of thing, and I don't know what, if there's any conversation later you want to do about that, but it came up as an issue from some folks.
We'll take that up at the end.
Yep. Thank you.
If there's an interest.
If there's interest, yeah. Okay.
So on the next item on the agenda are actually have been distributed prior to the board meeting. So I'm assuming, Lyle, your summary is to, if anyone had questions they would ask, and opposed to going through.
Yep.
So in regards to municipal services, policy and planning, public safety and homeland, transportation, and the capital workforce partners, is there any specific questions in regards to the summaries that have been presented in the monthly report that anyone would like to raise at this time for either clarification or further discussion? Seeing none, I guess we'll move on. So the next item on our agenda is actually a presentation and updates, and We're delighted to have Sarah Shaw of Connecticut Voices with us today. And Connecticut Voices for Children 2020 to 2022 issue a briefing book. And Sarah, where is she on my, I don't see her anymore. Here. Sarah, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, there you are. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So this is Sarah Shaw. And Sarah, do you want to do your presentation for us?
Yeah. Erin, can you please share the deck, please?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. My name is Sana Shah, and I'm the Chief of Staff at Connecticut Voices for Children. We are grateful that you have shared your space with us today. It's been an unprecedented year. We're living through a pandemic, a racial reckoning, tropical storms, and tornadoes. What's more, following the longest economic expansion in U.S. history, Connecticut now faces a coronavirus-induced recession. To help support the state through the various crises at hand, we have developed and released Connecticut Voices for Children's 2020 to 2022 issue briefing book, and we're pleased to present an overview to you today. We've also posted a link to the full report in the chat box. Connecticut Voices for Children is a research-based advocacy organization, AKA Think and Do Tank. At Voices, we envision a Connecticut that is thriving and equitable and where all children can achieve their full potential. Last fall, we engaged in a strategic planning process, and this past winter, we unveiled our new aim toward economic justice. To help advance our strategic aim, we're focused on the research and policy umbrellas of family economic security and the undergirding fiscal and economics. The COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted longstanding inequities in the United States. Historically, invisible communities are now visible, and their challenges have been brought to the public policy discourse. Connecticut is facing the most dire unemployment crisis since the Great Depression. Our state's unemployment rate has increased from 3.8% in February 2020 to an official peak of 10.2% in July, the highest on record. What's more, Connecticut's Black and Latinx workers have the highest rates of infection and death. Both of these things exacerbate an already wide wealth and income gap, which disproportionately harms Black and Brown children and families. Although our state and nation are going through a time of great strife, we at Connecticut Voices for Children see this as an opportunity to address the systemic and structural issues that allow and enforce our racial and economic divides and work together toward economic justice. Our issue briefing book includes data relevant to emerging public health issues, issues of family economic security, and the undergirding fiscal and economics, as well as federal issues that can help Connecticut rebuild equitably. Erin Sheehan, our legislation and data analyst, will now present an overview.
Hi, everyone. My name is Erin Sheehan. I'm a legislation and data analyst at Connecticut Voices for Children. So like Sana said, I'll just be giving a quick overview of the issue briefing book. Within the categories of emerging issues, family economic security, and fiscal and economics, I'll go through the challenges and consequences that we identified, some statewide data, solutions, and then a deep dive on our 2021 policy priorities. So just to start out, in the emerging issues category is public health. The COVID-19 pandemic is having a disparate impact on people of color. And unfortunately, this is a somewhat predictable outcome. Social and economic conditions are the most powerful indicators of who will survive the pandemic. Next, in the family economic security category is housing. First, limited affordable housing impacts opportunity, particularly for Black and Latinx children. In Connecticut, there just isn't enough affordable housing. Around 50% of renters statewide spend more than 30% of their income on housing, and only around 1 in 4 people eligible for housing subsidies actually receive them. We identified 2 main causes to this problem. First, exclusionary zoning. Exclusionary zoning laws include things such as parking requirements or high minimum lot sizes, and they make it more difficult to build affordable housing. Next, poor housing conditions. This is particularly a problem in Connecticut's largest cities. We've seen examples like apartment fires in New Haven, or the deterioration of public housing in Hartford to the point that it's deemed no longer safe to live in. This destroys more affordable housing options and forces primarily residents of color into unsafe housing conditions. Next, eviction uproots family and children. Connecticut has high rates of eviction, around 6% compared with the national average of around 4%. And due to the pandemic, Governor Lamont's administration has predicted a rate of anywhere from 7 to 13%, devastating the lives of those who experience eviction. Next is justice. First, undocumented families are particularly vulnerable during the pandemic. The main problem that they face is greater financial instability. They're more likely to face reduced hours, layoffs, and wage theft, and many are without a social security number and thus unable to access public benefits. Next, prisons are unhealthy environments, particularly during the pandemic. The infection rate of inmates is 699% higher than the state overall. This can be attributed to higher rates of chronic illness, a generally older population, and overcrowding in Connecticut's prisons. And finally, youth leaving state care and justice-involved youth face unique risks during the pandemic. Many of these individuals are struggling. A survey of youth in care found that 55% of youth are food insecure due to COVID-19, and 49% had their employment negatively affected. And finally, in the family economic security category is employment. First, Connecticut's early childcare industry has shrunk in its capacity to serve young children. Investing in early childcare is critical for future outcomes and employment opportunities for parents and childcare providers. Next, essential workers don't receive fair compensation. The work that they do in Connecticut isn't valued. They're more likely to have a household income of less than $40,000 and are less likely to be able to pay their bills in full. Moving on to fiscal and economics, Connecticut has an unfair tax system. Connecticut's tax system is considered progressive. This means it requires members of the working and middle class to pay more of their income in taxes than those of the upper class. The working class pays an average effective tax rate of 23.6%, compared with the wealthiest top 1% who pay an effective tax rate of just 6.5%. The next several slides go over some state level data and the recommended solutions that we make in the issue briefing book. For the sake of time, I'm just going to pass over these, but of course the slides themselves, in addition to the issue briefing book, goes into a lot more detail. Finally, I'll be doing a deep dive onto Connecticut Voices for Children's 2021 core policy priorities. These are in the areas of housing, justice, employment, and fiscal and economics, and they work together to make Connecticut a more economically just state. First, we recommend the Connecticut General Assembly create a COVID-19 response task force to track how funds are being administered. Second, we want to reform zoning laws in Connecticut. As I mentioned before, there isn't enough affordable housing in Connecticut. We're about to face a huge eviction crisis due to the pandemic, and affordable housing is a key long-term solution to preventing evictions. Changing zoning laws is one of the most important things that we can do to build more affordable housing. Next, we want to remove police from schools to make schools safer and save money. Next, we're looking to rescue Connecticut's early childcare industry. As I mentioned before, access to early childcare is crucial to future outcomes, but it also supports the economy. Investing in a robust early childcare system increases the number of parents participating in the workforce, as well as the number of businesses contributing to the economy. And finally, Connecticut Voices for Children's main policy priority is creating a fair tax system. In this moment, what people need the most is more money in their pockets, and a fair tax system would achieve that. As I mentioned before, we currently have a regressive tax system. Creating a fair tax system, in contrast, would ensure that upper-income individuals pay a larger share of their income in tax than do those with lower incomes. There are many ways that Connecticut can make the tax system more fair. For example, expanding the earned income tax credit or raising income taxes on the extremely wealthy. In December, we'll be releasing our full tax package that goes into much more detail on the recommendations made here and in the issue briefing book. So just to give a quick recap, our priorities are creating a COVID-19 task force, reforming land use controls, removing police from schools, rescuing early childcare, and raising revenue to create a fair tax system. With that, I'll hand it back over to Sunna.
Thank you, Erin. As you can see, the challenges are many and great. Connecticut has one of the highest levels of economic inequality in our nation, as well as racial disparities in education, housing, policing, and so much more. These have all contributed to the desperate blow COVID-19 has dealt to communities of color. However, we can and must do more to protect all Connecticut residents, not just those residents fortunate enough to have a job that allows them to save and build wealth, but also residents that are working multiple essential jobs and yet can barely make ends meet. Our state is currently experiencing a surge in COVID-19 cases. Thus, we will be tasked with particularly consequential decisions over how to respond to COVID-19 pandemic disastrous impacts on children and families. We need leaders like yourselves to support policies that allow equity to seed and grow and ensure all Connecticut's children reach their full potential despite our current crises. Together, we can achieve a strong economy that benefits all the state's residents. Thank you again for your time today. If you're interested, I can send an email that includes our deck and the issue briefing book, which again, I included in the chat. You can email me at sha@ctvoices.org if you have any further questions.
Thank you very much. Can I ask a question? How are you funded?
We're funded through various foundations and small donors.
And how long have you been up and running?
Since the 90s.
Okay.
since the early 90s.
And where are you working from? What is the organization's, where are you located?
New Haven, but we work statewide.
Very good, thank you so much. I had actually was texting Kim saying, I hope we can get a copy of the PowerPoint. It was very enlightening.
Absolutely.
And you both did a great job, so really appreciate it. Even though you cut it short, I think it would be interesting to have in our hands the PowerPoint so we can do a little bit deeper dive in there. I know we're probably gonna have some questions, and I see Scott Shanley from Manchester raising his hand, so Scott.
Yeah, hi, thank you for the presentation. I just had a couple of couple of questions on keeping police out of the schools. Are you referring to school resources officers, or are you saying do not respond when there are violent incidences in the school?
We're referring to school resource officers. We've just found that their presence, particularly in Black and Brown communities, increase arrests and just punitive discipline policies. And so by divesting in the criminal justice system, we're hoping to move those funds to counselors and social workers, and generally people who can support the social emotional needs of students. But that's not to say that there shouldn't be safety in schools. It's just saying that in regards to having a restorative and safe climate that mitigates the school to prison pipeline, we should remove police officers from school.
Right. You are aware, though, that in a lot of communities, the one that I work in, for example, there's a lot of teachers, a lot of administrators, and a lot of parents who are not supportive necessarily of removing them from the schools. So it's not it's not as easy politically as you may think. I'm wondering what you didn't address at all are Connecticut drug laws, and if you drill down underneath every one of your priorities, I think you'll find you're going to come to drug arrests and all of the challenges around drug arrests, the ability to find a job, the ability to pay your rent or find a rental unit. It's a huge underlying thing that we in Connecticut do not address. A change in our drug laws in Connecticut could have a huge impact on every single one of your priorities. Have you discussed that? And if you have, why isn't that part of your presentation?
Yeah, thank you for that. So justice work falls under our policy umbrella of family economic security. We haven't particularly done work in drug laws, but that's definitely something that I can bring back to some of our researchers and interrogate that. But we do things such as last legislative session, really advocating to raise the age of, in Connecticut, you're really young when you can actually enter the court system. And so we're trying to raise the age around that. And just in general, one of the big things that we do is work around our economy and safety. And so we've also been doing some research on folks who have been involved in the justice system or through any kind of like juvenile court, is how are we creating a pathway into the economy? So that's definitely something that we're working on right now. But as far as our justice work, what our legislative priority is for this upcoming session is, one, raising the age of court involvement, and two, this work around SROs. And I really hear what you're saying when it comes to challenges. This is actually a policy area, and I have been presenting this, and SROs is the one that is consistently flagged. And I will say that, so once upon a time, I was actually a teacher. And I taught in an urban center where the classes were overcrowded. We simply did not have resources, but what we did have was police officers in school. And so what I saw was a lot of teachers, because they were having trouble with classroom management, because they didn't have resources, because classrooms were overcrowded, they were delegating some of that behavior management to SROs, which is really dangerous. So we have to just look at supporting the education system in general. But those are really good points and something that we can look into.
And I appreciate you responding to all those. And that is absolutely correct. Our police department would leave the schools in a second if they were asked to.
Yep.
Because of all of those reasons that you just cited. And I just wanted to point out, let's just to be careful not to do, and this is going to sound like a political statement, it's not meant to be, don't do to juvenile justice what our current president wants to do with health care, and that is to replace it without having a replacement.
Yep.
We have, all of us on this call have experienced significant, for example, car theft issues with juveniles repeatedly because we didn't put in the replacement for removing them from the adult system. And we need to focus on that replacement. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm gonna echo some of Scott's statements, especially in regards to SROs in our school system. In East Hartford, we did find that our teachers were using the police for discipline purposes, and as a result of that, we did revisit what the role of the SROs are in the school system, and we did define through an MOU exactly what the processes would be and when the police would be activated or respond in their official capacity. But yet we understood that the relationship building with the students in the school was the top priority, not the physical response. So through an MOU, we were able to reshape our SRO program that more readily defined the roles of police within the scope of the school footprint. So I would say that we should be careful when we kind of look at SROs, especially since they vary in how they're activated from town to town, and really look at maybe the best practices that are in place already that are having great responses. We use our SROs more as a preventative measure for students getting into trouble, and to use them as a bridge and in partnership both with our school system and our youth services division and our JRB in a very proactive manner. So I would ask that you be cautious how you approach that. Thank you. Mark?
Thank you for that perspective.
Hi, I'm Mark Walter, Town Administrator for Columbia, and also the Chairman of the Land Use and Housing Community Development Policy Group for CCM. We're about to have a legislative meeting, and one of our reports addresses a concern you had that affordable housing is a result of zoning problems within the towns. But the real challenge, if you look at rural areas of our state, is not so much zoning, it's more dealing with the bureaucracy of DEEP and the Department of Public Health with subsurface wastewater systems, where there is really no clear definition from the Department of Public Health of how to do an alternate system for septic systems. Without that clear definition, we can't build systems that would normally need a sewer system in more congested areas. So we're trying to solve these issues, and we could use help in solutions more than blaming our zoning regulations, which are really because we need land and water to dilute septic and have clean drinking water in the rural areas. So I just wanted to bring that to light. Mm-hmm. We are trying to work on it through regulation as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the work that you all are doing. What I would add is we do talk a little bit about the wastewater management practices in the briefing book. So I think that's a really important aspect of housing and affordable housing. So thank you.
Any other questions?
We'll get the PowerPoint out, Madam Chair, to everybody. So that'd be great.
Thank you, Lyle. Great. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, Sam. I appreciate your time and the work that you're doing.
Absolutely. Thank you. And again, please email me with any questions.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, in light of time, not to cut Jean Goddard off from Metro Hartford Alliance, my suggestion would be to move the action items up so we don't lose our quorum.
Absolutely. So we have.
Lyle, if you want me to hold off to the next meeting, I certainly can do that.
No, if you can stick around, we just want to get our action items done. And Jean, if you're okay. Able to do that.
You bet.
Despite your great lakeside location there.
It's Connecticut River rated off of downtown East Hartford.
I don't know, it looked like Lake Calhoun to me, but anyway, all right.
So we have three action items in the first grouping, and then John has five in his area of transportation and metropolitan planning. So the first one is the CROG Legislative Committee, and we're seeking volunteer solicitation. So Lyle, do you have any?
Very quickly, Madam Chair, my suggestion is after the election, we will compose the CROG Legislative Committee again. My suggestion this year, given the current situation, is to have a relatively short agenda. We can have additional items of concern, but one of the issues is the state special transportation fund is very close to bankruptcy. There's a variety of very simple issues. So I guess my request would be to contact Kim or myself, board volunteer members. First Selectman Kervik and others have been kind enough to volunteer in the past, but we could use a committee of 4 to 6 people to go over this. So we soliciting volunteers.
So if there's anyone that's interested that's on the call or a member that's interested, they could reach out and maybe Kim can put the grouping together of all those that are interested. So appreciate it.
Thank you, Mayor.
John Alspazar, I just want to pitch in, make sure we keep crumbling foundations and the needs there high enough.
I would certainly guess. Yep. Is that a volunteering for the committee too, John? Or not?
Yes, it was.
All right.
Well. the next item is the 2021 draft policy board executive committee meeting, and I hope everyone had the opportunity to look it over. So if there's nothing else, I think we can take a motion to approve.
So moved.
Thank you.
Any discussion on any of the dates? If not, we'll all in favor?
Aye.
The motion carries. The next item is the action of the adoption of the resolution authorizing CROG Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities grant application. If Lynn's on there, if she wanted to do a quick summary or add some notations. Is Lynn on?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you. Just wanted to let you know it is time for us to apply for this grant. We're looking, it probably wouldn't get started though for another year. And we do want to, it's a five-year cycle We do want to have all participation from all of the communities. But the grant application is due in to the State Department of Emergency Management and Homeland Security by the end of November. Then they will package things up and send them to a complete application for the state to FEMA in January. So we won't hear for quite a while about this, but we do need to get the ball rolling on the grant application.
It is a routine application, Madam Chair. So.
Okay, is there any questions for Lynn? If not, is there someone who would motion to adopt the resolution?
Second, John Assessor.
All in favor? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. Okay, John, the next five action items are in your hands.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Pretty straightforward things we've done almost every year. The TIP amendments are fairly straightforward. A couple of bridges, a bunch of control signals being replaced. If anyone wants to know the specifics, the staff can provide it, but they're spread out all over the region. And then they're replacing some signs on the highway and then moving a couple of years around on the other things. And, the Transportation Committee has reviewed them, has approved them unanimously, and so recommends to the Policy Board, acting as the MPO, and I would so move.
Second.
Second.
Discussion?
I just have a question on, John Assessor, on the Section 5311 reduction of funding. That's our senior rides programs. I want to know what's going on there.
Yeah, yeah, we've contacted CONDOT, and they indicated to us that the initial number that they had in there was a placeholder. Now, why the placeholder was so much larger than the actual federal allocation that came through is a bit, still a bit of a mystery, but that is the actual federal allocation. The full amount that came through is being it's being modified to that full amount, which is much less than their placeholder was.
So are there impacts to our senior ride program if we say yes to this? Or is that de facto because that's the money that we actually got?
I think it's de facto.
John, this is Grayson Wright from CPDOT. The last email I saw from the project manager to one of your sister agents was that it has no impact on current services, on the service.
Thank you, Grayson.
You're welcome.
Okay, so all in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Okay, the motion carries. Next is the fiscal year 21-24 draft transportation improvement program. John?
Right, this is an annual action to take approving the three-year transportation program for the region, as well as the our share of the state TIP, which incorporates the regional TIP. And actually, items 11, 12, and 13 are somewhat all related, certainly 11 and 12. There are no surprises in the TIP. There are no great projects in it either. It basically keeps moving forward what we're doing now. The Transportation Committee again unanimously approved it and recommends same to the Policy Board.
So there's a motion on the floor. Do I have a
second?
Any further discussion? If not, we'll call for a vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. The next resolution before
number 12 is the air quality resolution. Again, one we do every year, basically certifies, and CONDOT has so certified to us that the activities, programs, and projects included in the TIP are in conformity with the air quality standards that we are required to maintain now and going forward over the next 3 years. Again, the Transportation Committee has reviewed it, approved it unanimously, recommend same to the policy board, and I again would so move.
Second.
Chip, thank you. Any discussion?
None? So this rules out cold fired buses?
For temporarily.
Thank you.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Motion carries. Next item is the resolution for urban planning.
This again is an annual resolution that we've been designated, you have been designated as an MPO, and that we have conducted all of our urban planning processes in accordance with the applicable laws and regulations, and that we have adopted the key planning documents on schedule as we were required to do. And again, and we have, and the Transportation Committee has reviewed and unanimously approved, recommended same to the board and the policy board, and I would so move.
Second.
Discussion? Seeing none, I'll call for a motion. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And the motion carries. The last action item, John?
Last item is the final report of the CROG's Route 4 Transportation and Safety Improvement Study has been completed. It was distributed and reviewed by the Study Advisory Committee back in May, and was reviewed and approved at public information meetings a couple of years ago. And the town, Farmington Town Council approved the thing both in May and again at their September 8th regular meeting, which are all of the approvals that are required to move the study along. The study is posted on the CROG website. And this resolution is for the final endorsement of the study. The Transportation Committee unanimously did endorse it, recommend same to the policy board, and I would so move.
Second.
Discussion?
Mayor, this is Matt Hart. I've got a quick question.
Yep.
John, do you or staff know if there are any cycling improvements in the plan?
Yeah, I would defer to staff. Rob?
There were some recommendations, but no major specific cycling improvements. There were quite a few PED improvements in the plan, and actually a community connectivity grant came out of this study. And but I don't recall a major soul cycling type improvement.
Okay. And the reason I ask is, as Lyle knows, I've got an interest in establishing buffered bike lanes from Farmington to Hartford through West Hartford. But thank you. I'll look at it in more detail at a later point.
Okay. I guess all those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? And the motion carries. So, Kathy, do you have an update for us?
Sure. There is zero happening with the legislature right now, not the least of which reason being the election coming up very shortly. There are no concrete plans as to how they will do session, how they will handle it. But more and more the belief is the building, the Capitol complex, will not be open globally. And they would rely on, by invitation only, appointment only for the public. They're looking into ways of handling public hearings, and how, you know, you all are aware of the fact they really never did anything as far as online, even for signups or anything. So they're moving through that, but slowly, mainly because there's going to be new leadership, and outgoing leadership has deferred it to those that come after them. I lost, there was one other thing, but I Matt Ritter will be the next speaker, and he is apparently urging, I'll leave it at that, the chairs, the committee leadership to really minimize the number of bills they will be reporting on, and really minimizing them. He is talking numbers as, you know, under 10 per committee. And not tying it into the change in operational issues that they'll have this year, but just as a change in how they do business going forward. So, and I don't remember it, but apparently when his father was speaker, it was handled much that same way. That committees really, really were the ones to separate out what was going to move forward. So that's the instruction moving forward. But we don't really know. We don't really know how they're going to handle their day-to-day operation.
It's a different environment to try to have less people making critical decisions, especially when
exactly
so many people want. It'll be interesting to watch that and see how that comes.
Interesting, and there are not as many openings. We had expected actually far more legislators not to run for re-election, there won't be that many. There are not that many open seats, so it will be interesting. And if there are changes in chairs, and there probably will be, particularly in the Senate, how that impacts. But I think Matt's going to be a very different speaker. And you may know more about it. It does sound like Jason is most likely going to be majority leader, obviously not announced yet. And the minority leader in the Senate is not, it sounds like Kevin Kelly from Stratford is most likely going to be, but not, again, anything close to an announcement.
Great, thank you, Kathy. Any questions for Kathy?
Madam Chair, John Assessor, two things. I'm very disheartened that Department of Housing has taken zero action on announcing community development block grants for small cities that we submitted our applications in April. Typically, they're supposed to be awarded in July. They've been slagging till August recently, but it is now, virtually November. And I point out that there's a federal statutory guidelines, a framework of how funds have to be expended or the state could lose the money. And the state has been penalized for that before. And what they typically do is once they do award the grants, you then have to go into the contract process, which takes another 2 to 3 months before you can do any activity. And they take that all out of your time frame. So we're already 6 months late in our time frames for our accountability to them. And somebody has to say something. I mean, this whole work at home for the state employees is not working. And I don't know how we can, it's not like the state economy couldn't use getting these federal funds out into our communities. It's not like the people whose projects may be benefited that have substandard housing couldn't benefit from this. It's insulting that it's not a priority. I think people have to, I don't know how do we as a cog start voicing that. The second thing is the steep grants. Again, money that could be out into our communities. We're now at the end of a construction season. Hard to do winter construction. So how come those haven't been awarded? I understand the decision's been made, or decisions have been made. I don't know what those results are, but they're pending the governor's office. So I'm looking for the Capital Region Council of Governments to at least ask questions and see what can we do on behalf of our citizens, our small contractors that would benefit from these jobs, to speak up.
John, have you been in touch with the governor's office?
I have not been in touch with the governor's office because I don't feel that I know the right people there. I guess I could go to Jonathan Harris. I know Betsy Guerra a couple weeks ago did try to go and got some information. But I think it has to be, I don't think it should be one-on-one is, I guess, my point. I think it should be organizational.
So I see that on the agenda we have Betty Guerra from COS. Is Betty on the phone or are you speaking on
the app? I'm on the phone and on camera. We have reached out in several times to both OPM and the Department of Housing relative to the respective grants. And we were told a couple months ago they were forthcoming. And we were told that the STEEP grants would be available announced by October 15th. I've noticed that they've now revised their website to say that they will be announced soon. So I will follow up today and I can work with Kathy Lutz to coordinate some follow up, and I'll also reach out to CCM because it is frustrating and people are waiting. And as John pointed out, we're gonna lose this construction season and that doesn't benefit anybody.
Well,
And I'm gravely concerned about the CDBG that they don't take it all out of our time, because then you get penalized and you can't apply for the next round. Their ineffectiveness shouldn't be borne by us.
So maybe on behalf of CROG, we can send a letter kind of asking them to address that, since we have quite a few small towns that are members of Capital Region Council of Government. And represent their interest in ensuring that they get their funding and it's appropriate and timely. So maybe there's some key elements, Betsy and John, that we can incorporate into that letter that you can send over to Lyle or Kim, and we can get something penned and into them immediately.
Madam Chair, if I may add this to this STEEP grant, one of the reasons when they updated the website, Chris Kervick from Winslow-Ox, I'm sorry. They said that, well, there's been 94 applications of the 130 eligible towns, but I was no math major, but if you take the grant limit of 128,000 and multiply it by the number of applicants, it's within the $15 million limit that they announced. So they could give everyone who applied the grant and stay within the limit that they announced. So there's something afoot beyond that, and it's very mysterious.
Mark?
Mark Walter, Town of Columbia. Just one other thought too, the executive orders I think need to be extended. We're all about to start our next budget season with a lot of municipal requirements for town meeting and the entire process of authorizing funds and transfers and everything. So I don't know if the governor's waiting for the legislative body to come back into session in January, if he doesn't want to extend it too far, but my recommendation is CROG could advise the governor to extend it 6 months, and then if legislatively they want to modify any of the orders after January, go for it. But I need to know how I'm going to operate my government.
Okay. Get some answers on that. I thought they had clarified and extended the ability for municipalities to continue remote.
So I can address that with this is Betsy.
Oh, Betsy, you're down on the bottom of my screen. I'm looking. Go ahead, Betsy.
CCM, COST, and a group of municipal attorneys have been working with the governor's office to try to address these things. I think initially the governor had planned on extending the public health emergency and the executive orders until February. However, after meeting with both Democratic and Republican leaders, decided to shorten that time frame, and now they're in place until November 8th. following the election. So I fully expect that once the election is over, that there will be an effort to then extend those executive orders. We have been successful in getting an executive order issued that would explicitly authorize towns to hold hybrid remote in-person meetings. And we are developing guidance. However, we're bumping up against some questions as to how that guidance should look, because we still haven't addressed how, for example, if you're a town meeting form of government, how you can authenticate voters participating remotely in a town meeting in a way that's not going to invalidate any action taken. So I think we're already starting to talk with the governor's office about the need to extend those provisions that authorize either the Board of Selectmen or the Board of Finance and town meeting forms of government to adopt a budget or take certain critical actions. But there's certain hesitancy to do that because people are concerned that they're infringing on the right of voters, the residents, to actually participate in their town meeting process. So again, we're part of those discussions, but it's not an easy answer right now. And we'll be reaching out for more guidance on that.
And I certainly don't want to speak on behalf of what their intention is, but I do think now with the uptick in the COVID positivity rate that they probably didn't want to extend too long, but we'll probably see. And if we raise that as an issue, probably see them extend it, the existing abilities. So anyone else have any questions or concerns? Mark, back to you. You good or?
I'm good.
Okay. Mayor Matt Hart, West Hartford. Yeah. Question for Catherine. I was wondering if what you think the likelihood of getting a bill authorizing municipal stormwater utilities might be. I know CCM is pushing that. It's a big issue for West Hartford and other MDC towns as well.
That had been floated last session.
Pick them and play the presidential election game. Enter for free.
I'm sorry. I'd have to look it up because I can't remember if it ever even got to a public hearing. But certainly it had been a priority last year. Last year wasn't the first year they've looked into it either. So I'll go back and see things that had support in last session and were not assumed, but as much as anything could have been assumed to have moved forward, will, you know, have a better potential of being top of list when they go in January.
Thank you.
I did have this is Bob Bessel in Canton. I did have a question about the police accountability bill. There's a clause in there that mandates CALEA as the sole accrediting agency for police, local police departments. Do you get any sense of why Connecticut Post was not included as an accrediting agency for local police departments?
No, that piece of it, I don't recall it being, I don't. I mean, I can look into it. I have not heard back from Senator Winfield on his willingness to come to a crowd meeting and get some information or be willing to answer some questions. That I didn't hear, and Betsy, you might have, but I didn't hear about that piece of it as being under consideration for changes.
Well, I thought my reading of the bill was that it was an either or, that you could continue with the post certification or pursue CALEA certification or CALEA. But we did actually have Coventry's police chief, Mark Palmer, discuss that in a webinar and talking about the fact that he's a certification, I don't know what the title is, but an officer for CALEA, and that it isn't as expensive as people believe. And that requirement goes into effect in 2025. So there is some time to change it. I think right now it's, there was certain reluctance to do anything in special session to fix the bill. But I think certainly when, as towns are starting to grapple with some implementing some of the provisions, there may be more of an appetite for that when we convene in regular session.
Madam Chair, we've been trying to get a briefing on this, and we're facing elections and other kinds of things. So we're trying to get a briefing on the whole police accountability bill for the board as a whole, too, just as you know.
And just one comment that I know from my own police chief, because we are CALEA certified, is the feedback from CALEA was this came out of nowhere for them, and they don't even have the infrastructure to take on the expansion of that. So that's a secondhand comment from my police chief in regards to the recommendation or the what the bill is saying that they have to be and or in CALEA, and CALEA saying they it's difficult for them to take on multiple towns at one time anyway. So
yeah, we did a reading of the bill, and there was no and or, it was yeah. CALEA, and there was no mention of Connecticut Post at all. And I believe that there are about twice as many post accredited police departments in the state than as there are CALEA. So if the intent of the bill is to get police departments accredited and operating on a standard, POST seems to be a much more efficient way to do it.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Scott.
Yeah, we're CALEA certified as well. Are the standards the same for CALEA and POST? Mr. Bessel.
I believe they're very close. I know that POST was derived from CALEA with some, my impression is that some local policing, Connecticut policing standards were added to it. But but POST follows the CALEA accreditation standards very closely.
Well, it would seem to me that, I mean, just if CALEA certified POST's certification, then
it's done. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure there'll be more information that will come out.
The reality is that you need both, because we just got our CALEA recertification, and now this year we have to do this state. It would be an area to look at whether there's duplication.
Actually, yep. John, that's only because you're Coventry. Nobody else has to do that.
I will say they have different standards for smaller towns. They throw some of the standards out. So it's easier for smaller towns like Canton to get CALEA certified than it is Manchester. And rightfully so.
It was quite a process for East Hartford to go through the requirements.
Yeah, it's no fooling around.
Yep. So aside from, if you're saying there's not a lot of cost, there is cost, and there's ongoing costs that you incur to continue to get recertified. And there's a lot of work that has to go in to ensure that you're going to get certified. So there's a lot of staff time that's devoted to meeting those, setting the policies and ensuring the compliance. And it's not just about policing, it's about how your building functions. It's about a lot of broad issues.
All your records and policies and so forth.
Record management, file cabinets.
I would push for all people that are certified to push that we get a reduction in our police liability insurance, because that's the whole theory behind here. And right now it does not impact insurance rates.
Very good point.
Because that would pay for some of the costs of the process.
Yeah.
So we're hoping to have a fuller discussion of this when we get a briefing on the police accountability bill, and we can, in the meantime, pursue some of these questions. So.
Okay. All right. So the only other business to come before is to take up the topic of Halloween, and I don't know.
Madam Chair, we have Gene Goddard from the Metro Hartford Alliance, who's been very patient. Sorry.
We did move you, Gene.
You were very patient. Thank you, Gene. Don't want to drop him off the agenda after all that.
It's okay. If you need to draw me, that's fine. How long do you want me to take, Lyle?
That's good.
Yep. Go for it.
All right. Let me just get to the meat of the matter then. Here we go. Let me share my screen. All right. So I'll skip the beginning part, but just basically summarize by saying that many of the national studies that look at state business taxes have not placed Connecticut in high ranking, largely because of the way we tax individuals and partnerships and other types of companies. When we look at C corps, we're in a much better position. So we're looking at trying to create a marketing narrative to keep the companies that we have today and attract new ones into the community and into the state. We wanted to get a better handle of what the effective tax rate was for our region and for the state. And so we reached out to Cohen Resnick to be our partner in this analysis to try to figure out what our true effective tax rate was again. So we made some assumptions. We looked at C corporations rather than partnerships or individual companies were the pass-through entities. We looked at a manufacturer or warehouse with $50 million in revenue, $7 million income in COGS, 150,000 square foot building, valued, you can see the values there, $20 million M&E, 250 employees, and kind of down the road, the assumptions that we made. And looking at the region, we wanted to consider you know, a community that has a lot of availability of land, that has both manufacturing and warehouses. So we chose Windsor. And then we compared ourselves against communities around the country that we compete with regularly for projects. So Charlotte, Columbus, Plano, Texas, and Tyson, Virginia. So we wanted to, again, an effective tax rate analysis takes all the taxes that a company pays and based upon our assumptions. So it includes personal property, real property, income, sales, unemployment insurance taxes, everything combined, including mosquito control districts, schools, whatever you want to think of, pulling them all together. So when you look at the numbers on the left-hand column, the total tax number, that's where we rank. So Windsor came in at $750,000 roughly a year in annual taxes. Charlotte took the lead at $705,000. Columbus, $825,000. Plano, Texas, in a state that always talks about how low their corporate taxes are, ended up at $1.1 million. In Tyson, Virginia, at $927,000. So you can see in the columns and the rankings below where we fit among these five locations. You know, again, income tax, we don't turn out real well on, and state unemployment insurance tax, that's a huge hit for us. And our property tax is the other big area where we get kicked off for. But when you add everything up, we came in second place Windsor came in second place out of these five locations. So we have a narrative now that we can talk about rather than always what these national studies do is that when they look at statutory published rates, they don't really take in the time and the effort that's needed to dig in deeper. We can talk about us being a cost-effective location for businesses, particularly manufacturing and warehouse operations facilities. We also did the same. We wanted to do a comparison between New York, Boston, and Hartford for office space. Knowing all the articles that are in the papers that you read about people from Boston and New York wanting to move out to get away from the density and move into a less dense location, or say want to live on a golf course or in a wooded area instead of living in downtown Manhattan and paying the exorbitant prices there. So I wanted to do a comparison also. Again, we chose a C Corp, $5 million in net revenue, a 20,000 square foot lease, which is a typical floor plate in downtown Hartford, 50 employees with an average wage of $30 an hour. And you can again see the rest of the assumptions down below. Again, we wanted to compare an apples to apples rather than the comparisons that other, the other studies do. So when we pulled those numbers together, this is how we compare for Hartford. Hartford came in with total taxes of $260,000 roughly, Boston at $406,000 roughly, and Manhattan at roughly $445,000 a year just in taxes alone. Again, this is all the combined taxes rather than just the individual or the corporate income tax, looking at everything across the board. And then if you look at the far right column, when you look at the lease numbers, this is what a Class A office space would be. We use Code and Resnick. They actually have Class A office space in downtown Manhattan. They have it in downtown Boston and in downtown Hartford. So these are the lease rates that they would pay comparatively for those three locations. And as you can see, combined, we are significantly lower for the office space as well. So as we're trying to create a narrative again to recruit companies to come to our region or stay in our region and grow and expand, we have a significant cost option to offer to these businesses on top of the better quality of life that we have, the better educational systems that we have, the lower cost of living in those locations. So we wanted, you know, with the shortness of time, I wanted to share this with you all. I'm happy to share the spreadsheets with you that we have behind it so you can look more detailed, or if you want to put your own community's number in into the spreadsheet rather than Windsor's or Hartford's, but I stand ready for any questions that you may have.
Gene, thank you very much. That's very interesting. Great compilation of where we stack up against the communities.
Yep, Madam Chair?
Yes, Scott.
I'm just curious, Gene, how is this? I think it's terrific. It's a very interesting way of doing it. How is this information, aside from marketing the Metro Hartford Alliance does, how does this information get out to just individual people in the state who sometimes are our worst ambassadors?
Yeah, I've learned that a little bit. We tend to kick the dog that we're petting at the same time. We've been a little swamped with our Insurance Capital Summit over the last few weeks, but we're beginning a marketing campaign over the fall here to individuals within and individual companies. I'll be doing presentations like this to business organizations around the state so they can get a chance to see some of these numbers. We also reach out to corporate real estate executives, both the Cornet Global folks here in the state, but also on a national level to those corporate real estate folks that are doing site selection analysis for potential clients that would come here. We've also included this information in the number of proposals that we've been working together in partnership with DECD and Advanced CT. And the responses that we've been getting are, yeah, we kind of knew that the national numbers were a little off, but this makes an argument for us to want to put the project here because of access to labor, access to supply chain, access to the Eastern Seaboard. So we're real excited about this moving forward. And if you have folks that you need us to talk to walk them through the analysis, be happy to do that.
Madam Chair, I was going to suggest we put this in the CROG newsletter. And also circulate the PowerPoint just to get it out to all of our members in terms of that. Sorry, just a suggestion.
I think that's a really good idea because I think certainly the board of directors for whom I work could really benefit from this kind of a single page plus the other single pages. Yep. Just a three-page document tells a huge story.
Yep.
If I could suggest that maybe you reach out to Keith Faniff, who's a really good numbers person. And he could take your numbers and maybe use it
for an article. And short of that, if he doesn't, that you write it up for viewpoints. I think what we're talking about is that the audience is beyond a corporate audience. The audience is within the state of Connecticut, are of our citizens. And it's a good story. I appreciate all the effort. It's very helpful that somebody's taking the time and effort to do this, but we got to market it well, beyond just the corporate buying, but to change the attitude of our citizens.
Yep. So I'm also interested, Gene, in taking a sample of this whole Pratt & Whitney Raytheon expansion into North Carolina now and using that as a metric for, would a corporation take the upfront cost when the long term, when they're going to pay on the long term and what that means for them? There must be a, where did he go anyways? Where's Gene?
He's there.
Oh, there he is over there. I've changed the view.
On my screen right next to me.
So I'm wondering how we can use an example in the metrics to kind of play to why they should have reconsidered and kind of looked at staying in Connecticut.
Yeah, we already shared this information with the folks at Pratt & Whitney, and the only argument that they came back from us is that the value of the building that we use, you know, the $15 million square foot, our value for 150,000 square foot building may not be quite accurate compared to all those five locations. It may have a higher value or lower value somewhere else, but we need to do an apples and apples comparison. Largely what we continue to hear from the corporate community is access to talent, talent, and talent. Those are the top three things that they're working or looking for.
Yep.
And that's why at our November meeting, we're going to be talking to you all about our All Heart Talent Attraction Program that we'll be running out this fall, that so you can see what we're doing to attract workforce across the spectrum and across the three counties of the region.
So I also wonder, with the construction of Raytheon plant down to North Carolina, they're not going to have the necessary as much talent access as they would up here. They're going to be spending a significant amount of money to relocate their employees down to a North Carolina to bring that talent there in infusion. So I don't know. I just think there's an example there that maybe if we run the numbers, it really could speak to the value. I also am wondering if there isn't an opportunity to showcase this not only to those that real estate people in corporations, but really to put it in front of the the round table and get it out to the top talents within the corporations as a way to have their fingerprints on it as well. Thank you.
I wonder Mayor LeClaire, whether and I don't know the answer, but I wonder if I wondered about labor costs, whether or not that's what they're looking at. Their annual labor costs may be significantly less to offset any other.
I think they referenced the union costs, definitely. Was an issue, yeah. But that also needs to be looked at. I mean,
exactly. That's the other another study that we're working on, because when you look at percent of labor, some of those studies hit us pretty hard, the workforce that's in labor, but it's mostly the public employees unions where we have the highest percentage of workers. But when you look into the manufacturing sector or into the trade sector, we're less unionized than other locations. And when you look at North Carolina, Louisiana, Virginia and South Carolina, where you've seen, and Tennessee also, where you've seen huge influx of manufacturers, particularly in those that are moving from traditionally high union states, they're finding that their unionization levels in those states are actually higher than the states that they're leaving, because they tend to have more people in manufacturing that are unionized than the states that they come from. So it's not always a right-to-work state. It's aren't always the panacea that some companies think that they are going to be.
Thank you. Any other questions for Gene?
I have one there. Gene, are you going to do this for LLCs, sole proprietors, and partnerships? Because I think that's where a lot of the Connecticut angst comes from, is self-employed people and small groups that say it's terrible and they're taxing me to death.
Yeah, since the Alliance focuses the majority of our work on companies that are tend to be C corps, you know, 50,000 square foot building, $1 million in capital investment, and at least 50 new employees. That's where we spend a lot, you know, trying to do head of household type job creation in the state. We probably won't. Looking at these numbers, it's pretty clear that, and other states that I've worked in, it's pretty clear we hit those sole proprietorships and pass-through entities much harder than we should. And that's, again, why those national numbers, particularly the Tax Foundation numbers, rank us so poorly, is because of the way we do those pass-through dollars, those pass-through entities.
Because I think those are the people that are Pratt's supply chain, you know, 25 person shops and things like that. $1 million or $2 million isn't very much to invest anymore. So I think we ought to get a hold of that, because that could be affecting Raytheon's idea, depending on what they can get for supplies in other states compared mm-hmm. to here.
I appreciate that. That's a great comment. We'll again take a look at that. I was able to use, Cohen Resnick is a investor in the Alliance, they did this work for us on a pro bono basis. I know they spent well over $60,000 in staff time to do this work for us. So if you or others or the CROG or any other entities can help us finance the additional work that we need to be done, would be fantastic. It's not something that I can pull out of my, all of our budgets are tight right now because of COVID. Particularly those of us that are nonprofit organizations that rely upon businesses to make money to finance our work. So if you guys can help me out with that, then I'd be happy to move forward. Lyle, open up the pocketbook there, buddy.
Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd like to have a conversation with Gene about this. And I think getting the information out that you presented today, plus the additional information that was requested, I think is something very important, because I think the facts are actually better than people think they are, which is a reason to get them out. I mean, they're not perfect and there's still a lot of negatives, but these are much better numbers. When you look at the total cost of operations, it's worth doing, but I'd love to have a conversation about this, Gene, and get this information out to our board.
Yep. When you think we're 38% lower than Plano, Texas.
Yep.
Business costs. That's a fantastic story to tell.
Yep.
How does that weigh against the overall kind of metrics that take into account and its quality of life and weather and real estate, what's available in the real estate market and the, you know, square foot costs for those types of things? In Texas, certainly people are going to go down there and be intrigued by the housing market and the size of and the quality of the homes and that in the area. So, I mean, that has to be taken into consideration as well.
Right, the cost of living, I don't know what the actual term is, Gene, but there's a multiplier. In other words, if you make $70,000 a year in Connecticut, how much do you have to earn in Texas to have the same quality of life? And it's probably $45,000. I mean, it's pretty grim, but I don't know, Gene, if you have a comment on that. But.
Yeah, there are lots of calculators that we can use that are done by multiple organizations. You know, Wallet Hub is one that has one. There's several others that are out there. Connecticut is, when you look at one level of 100, is kind of the national average. We are at 109. Many other Texas locations, depending on the community, can be lower than that. But I spent a lot of time working with companies in Dallas trying to attract them and help them grow into other places. And Texas gets you in the pocketbook from the local government level. They may not get you at the state level, but they hit you really, really hard in the property tax at the local level. So it's, you know, and we're north of the Mason-Dixon line. We have snow. Fantastic. You know, I've talked to many people in Texas over the last month, and they all said, God, we'd love to have some snow.
Versus hurricane floods.
Exactly. Dallas is much like our region with the quality of higher educational institutions that we have. They have, you know, they have the same amount of Fortune 500 companies that we have. The approaches may be different, but the in the end results, we're very similar location to Dallas. And that is a place where we can go out and attract companies. I've had a lot of success from there in the past. I know how to tell the story. Now that we've got the data behind it, we even got a better message to share.
That's super. Thank you so much, Gene, for sharing that with us. It's really interesting material. And will you be able to, will we be able to have a part of that PowerPoint?
Yeah, I already sent that over to your team a couple weeks ago, so they should have it, be ready to send out. And Lyle, love to talk with you more. And then maybe once we all get that EDA grant, how we can use some of those monies to help augment some of the work that we're doing right now and focus on those smaller companies that we really need to support and grow within the region that are part of the national supply chain for Pratt.
Madam Chair, I was thinking as part of our comprehensive economic development strategy update, it's really good to have this kind of factual information.
How does that fold into our SEDS? Yeah. Great. All right.
Thanks, Gene.
The last item to come up before us is a discussion on Halloween. Who was it that wanted to raise the discussion? And
I'm not sure they're on the call, but I've had questions about it. If there's no interest on the meeting, I didn't mean to belabor it. It was a question on clarity. There are guidelines from the state, and towns have issued various guidances. So I'm not sure if there's no one on the call that's interested in it. I just want to bring it up from a question I had.
Anyone interested in having that discussion? It's Saturday. I think we should have already had our
That's too late.
All right. Any other business to come or discussions to come before the committee? If none, I think I'll take a motion to adjourn.
So move.
Second.
Lori Spielman.
Okay, great. All in favor?
Aye.
Have a fantastic rest of the day.
Thank you.
Thanks, yep. Bye. Bye-bye. Bye.